I have a message from another time. A Reproductions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a Duelist Opera, Second Movement, Clarion Call, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, with Janice Collier. Thursday, March 4th, 2410. Green Sector Central Habitat, The Garden. International Police Station, Babylon 6, Bahava L System, Centaurus Sector. Scold Ravenhair never got tired of the garden. By her lights, it was the cleverest thing about Babylon 6's design. She'd always had a bit of a fondness for space habitats that tried to be more than just a hull to keep the air in, and the sensation of standing in B6's hollow center and looking up at the inside-out world of the habitat ring was one of the finer examples of the genre. B6 wasn't the biggest space station around, it wasn't the most luxurious, and it for damn sure wasn't the most technologically advanced. It didn't even have artificial gravity in the normal operating regime. But it did have this one peerless place. A fitting spot for her only son to get married in. Finding a venue for the occasion hadn't been easy. Most of the places she and her sisters had thought of first turned out to be too small, given the truly spectacular number of people who had, as a matter of course, to be invited. Those on the original list that were large enough were, by and large, lacking the right atmosphere for such an occasion. For example, the Avalon County Coliseum would probably have done space-wise, but there was no way Scold was going to agree to that, and while both she and Corwin might have been all right with the second choice on the list, the New Avalon Battledrome, Beldandy had vetoed that one. At their wits' end, the sisters had turned the matter over to the father of the groom, who hadn't managed to think of anything better. In the end, it was someone entirely unconnected to the occasion who made the winning suggestion. Wednesday, March 3rd, 2410. And we still don't have a decent place to have the thing. We thought the castle would be plenty big enough until we actually bothered to do the math. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. I mean, if it were summer, we could do it outdoors in New Avalon, say in Avalon Center Park or Veterans Park, or on Gerardo out next to the castle. But it's freaking March, and of course we had to put DSM in a climate band that more or less matched with New Avalon. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. So that's no good. Everybody'd freeze to death. Griffin threw up his hands. Site prep needs to start no later than tomorrow morning. This is a complete disaster. Corwin's going to kill me, if Utrina doesn't get to me first. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. Oh, hey, leave it to me, I said. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. I figured, what the hell? I'm Mr. Big Time Organizer, right? I put the Wedge Defense Force back together. I organized the IPO. I kicked off New Avalon, for Christ's sake. How hard could it be? Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. But can I do a simple thing like find a place for my son's wedding? No, that's apparently a task quite beyond my... Derek put a hand on Griffin's shoulder and said in a tone only fractionally less mild. Griff... Griffin skidded to a verbal halt and sighed. Yes, Derek. Derek pointed out the window of the Babylon 6 core shuttle they were both riding. Have it there, he said. Now, Scold and her sisters were on the scene, supervising the station's public affairs staff as they prepped a grassy area in the middle of the habitat ring to serve as the venue for an outdoor ceremony. Truth to tell, there wasn't really a lot of supervising to be done. This was far from the station staff's first rodeo, as it were. They knew how to handle the basic broad strokes stuff, All they needed from the Norns was help with the specifics. Bell had the catering well in hand, of course, and, though the very thought still filled some part of Skuld's soul with fear, Erd was looking after the entertainment. For once, Caitlin would be able to participate in the occasion without having to wrangle the musicians as well. Fortunately, Erd wasn't seeing to that personally, but she was overseeing the arrangements all the same. Which left Skuld with a task important not so much to the ceremony itself as to its traditional preparations. The meadow where the ceremony was to be conducted was physically already prepared. The chairs were arranged, the dais, the canopy, all of it ready to go. Skuld's job was to see to the construction, a short distance away, of two proper Asgardian bathhouses. Unlike the setup for the wedding, this was something the staff of Babylon 6 had no previous experience with, though they were proving to be highly adaptable and competent as Skuld directed them through the process. They'd have the houses up and functional in plenty of time, though she didn't even want to ask where they'd found the wood, either for it or for the feast hall Erd was seeing to at the other end of the meadow. All in all, and despite the fantastically short notice, there was no indication that the thing would come off in any way other than well. Many of the really important preparations weren't dependent on the venue and had been taken care of weeks before, and the last-minute uncertainty over the location wouldn't be a problem for anyone on the guest list with the kind of transportation network this particular couple could call upon. They'd all known they'd be going somewhere on Friday the 5th. It was up to the guides to make sure they got wherever it was. No problem. Yeah, it looked like this was going to go according to plan after all. International Police Visiting Officers Quarters, Blue Sector, Babylon 6. Having been told in no uncertain terms to take himself out of the way while more competent persons handled the rest of the logistics, Benjamin Hutchins had little to do with himself. So he spent the morning in his seldom-used office on Babylon 6, mostly chopping through the expediting paperwork for his latest unofficial project. With that done, he resisted the urge to go snoop around the garden and instead took himself down to the VOQ, a block of staterooms set aside for the use of, as the name implied, IPO officers without a permanent billet aboard the station. As he stepped off the lift into the corridor segment set aside as the VOQ, he paused for a moment to return the salute of the uniformed TACTIV officer on duty. Must be a new guy, he thought, then headed down toward the second room from the end. As he approached, Griffin thought he could hear faint music seeping into the hall. That was slightly odd, given how heavily insulated all the quarters were aboard the station, but he didn't think too much about it. If anything, it gave him a mild feeling of nostalgia. It felt like walking down a dormitory hallway of an early evening, in those near-forgotten mythic days before the universe took a sudden right turn, feeling the bass of somebody's favorite study music rumbling through the floor but able to make out little else about the tune. He stopped at the room he wanted, keyed the annunciator, and waited. Nothing happened. He keyed it again. Still nothing. Well, he thought wryly, I am the chief. He punched an override code into the keypad. The door opened, and a wall of sound nearly bowled him over as it poured out into the corridor from the room beyond. Griffin staggered briefly, more out of surprise than anything else, then regrouped and stepped inside, and damn near burst out laughing. There was really no other response a reasonable man could make to the sight of two robots, one sleek and ultramodern, the other blocky and utilitarian, dancing together to the sounds of 20th-century rock music blasting at an imprudent, but, Griffin noticed with approval, crystal-clear, volume from the chest panel of one of them.
Mama!
Griffin tried to keep quiet. Why intrude on such a carefree moment if he didn't have to? But the deck was stacked against him, and when the little tracked robot managed, despite his awkward construction and the fact that his dance partner had no legs at all, to pull off a nice approximation of a spin and dip, he couldn't stop himself from laughing any longer. A lot of men would have been, at the very least, annoyed to find themselves in this situation. The more sophisticated robot was, soon he was fairly sure to be, had been, his property, the brand new product of a concerted research and development effort spanning nearly 10 years and costing a number of credits he hadn't even bothered to have anyone count for fear of finding it depressing. Had been, until he'd sent her off on her shakedown mission and she'd returned, not only with the object of her search, but also with a beat-up, antique, wall-series trash compactor droid and the unmistakable signs of true sapience. Griffin wasn't a lot of men, and anyway, he happened to think robots developing true sapience was pretty damn cool. It didn't appear as though Eve had really gotten accustomed to the idea yet, though. At his laugh, she turned her head, blinked, and then reached out with a lightning-quick hand to punch the stop key on Wally's playback controls. The music stopped instantly, and Eve snapped to something as close to attention as a levitating robot whose arms and head were not, strictly speaking, actually attached to her body could manage, her uncannily expressive blue LED matrix eyes wide with surprise. Wally, facing away from the door and thus unaware of precisely how the situation had changed, kept dancing for a couple of seconds, before Eve gave him a sharp poke akin to an elbow in the ribs and hissed his name in an exasperated tone out of the side of her hidden vocoder. Puzzled, Wally slid to a halt and gave his companion a confused look. Eve tilted her head toward the door and muttered tersely, "Chief!"
"Huh? Oh!"
Wally about-faced smartly, and at last took notice of their visitor. Instead of reacting with startled embarrassment, though, he waved cheerfully and made a carefully modulated electronic noise that was almost, but not quite, "Hi-o!" Griffin collected himself, but didn't stop, couldn't stop, grinning as he stepped into the room and let the door shut behind him. "Good choice of tune," he observed. "Hot-blooded. Foreigner, 1978. At ease, Eve. You're off duty," he added with a wink. "Anyway, I have good news. I just got off the phone with the Turing Institute. They're sending a field evaluator to have a look at you this afternoon. She'll run a few simple tests, and I expect that'll be that. You guys won't belong to anyone." Eve blinked, her eye expression changing from embarrassed surprise to simple astonishment. Griffin figured he knew more or less what was running through her head. She'd been online for just over a month, she'd completed only a single mission, and already she was on the verge of becoming a free intelligence. A lot of robots spent their entire operational careers and never developed that strange, ineffable spark, and here were two of them. Two who had found each other, to boot. What were the odds? As Griffin thought it, he realized that Eve could probably calculate them. "Anyway, it's nothing to worry about. Having seen you two in action, I can't see how it's anything other than a formality, but I wanted to warn you ahead of time so you had a chance to get ready. You know, psyched up." He grinned and had a better look at them. "You look good," he told Eve. "Those scuff marks buffed right out." She bobbed slightly in the air, looking a trifle bashful. Griffin turned his attention to Wally. "How about you? Feeling good?" Wally nodded vigorously. Truth be told, he found it all a little overwhelming. All his life, he'd known only the grunge and toil of the scrapyard, with only the endless vistas of refuse to look at and only Hal, his pet cockroach, for company. To be suddenly swept up and transported to this place of clean, precise lines, shiny new machinery, and friendly people. Well, he wouldn't have traded it, for certain, but all the same, it was going to take some getting used to. All this was quite beyond his ability to articulate, doubly so since he wasn't fitted with a vocoder, and so could only roughly approximate speech using his industrial signaler. But that didn't bother him either. He was quite capable of doing all the communicating he needed to do. "Well, I won't keep you," Griffin said. "I'll be back when I escort the Turing evaluator down, probably in a couple of hours. In the meantime..." He gestured, smiling, to Wally. "Carry on." Wally perked up and reached for his play button, but before he could press it, Eve held out a hand in a just-a-second gesture, and then darted to intercept the chief before he could leave. "Chief," she said, looking a bit worried. "Yes?" he asked. Eve paused, as if considering how to put what she had to say. Though she was equipped with a proper vocabulator, she didn't talk much. Griffin wasn't sure whether she hadn't developed a full free speech facility yet or was simply taciturn by nature. Finally, trusting him to understand what she was getting at, she looked searchingly at him and said, "Directive?" Griffin blinked. "Directive," he mused. Then, brightening, he said, "Ah, I get it. Don't worry. We'll talk about that after the evaluator's made her decision." With a twinkle in his eye, he added, "I'm pretty sure we'll be talking about a job offer." Eve looked relieved and more than a little pleased as she moved out of his way. Griffin smiled to himself as he walked up the corridor, hands in pockets, and heard the music start up again before the door whined shut in his wake. The security officer saluted again as he drew near. Griffin paused, returning the salute again, and decided to let the kid in on the game. "It's okay if you don't salute me," he said, smiling. "We're not in the army." The young officer blinked. "Yes, sir. May I ask a question, sir?" Griffin hit the button to summon the lift, read the man's top pocket name tag, and said, "Fire away, Tech Officer Cassidy." "My watch commander told me this was a temporary posting. Why special security on this level today?"
"Just a precaution," he said. "I have a couple of friends in the VOQ today, and I don't want them to be bothered."
"The two robots?"
"That's right."
With a look that was more questioning than challenging, Griffin asked, "Got a problem with a man having robots for friends, Cassidy?"
The crew-cut young man went slightly pink.
"Oh, no, sir," he said quickly. "Absolutely not, sir. I'm from Regal."
"Ah," said Griffin.
"We're seeing more and more of you guys joining up since Sergeant Barlow started making the news. What section are you from?"
"Purple Numb, sir."
Griffin nodded.
"Well, carry on, Officer Cassidy. Nobody enters this floor without my authorization, at least until after our guest from Turing 3 makes her appearance."
He smirked slightly. "After that, any half-wit bot basher who gets it into his head to tangle with Eve is on his own." Cassidy chuckled.
"Amen to that, sir. Those guys don't last long back home. Usually just long enough to run into their first RA cast."
At the prescribed distance from the station, a black, wing-shaped spacecraft thundered out of hyperspace in a flash of light, then coasted quickly to a near halt before its sublight thrusters spooled up to power. In the cockpit, an unshaven, slightly scuffed young man smiled a tired smile, guided the vessel into the approach traffic pattern, and dialed his comm system.
"Babylon Control," he said. "This is Hotel Delta Kilo 8212, Private Starship One Hit Wonder, requesting permission to approach for docking."
"Roger, One Hit Wonder, I have you on my scope," replied the voice of Babylon Control. "Your vector looks good. You're cleared for approach. Is that you, Lieutenant Corwin?"
Corwin Ravenhair grinned.
"It is indeed, Lieutenant Corwin." He wasn't a lieutenant, strictly speaking, but what was the point of having a private joke if you weren't willing to bend the facts a little to accommodate it? Your parents are causing quite a stir down in Green Sector today, Lieutenant David Bruce Corwin informed him with audible amusement.
So I've heard, Corwin replied wryly. As if to underline the point, the Wonder slid past the sleek, silvery-white bulk of IPS Challenger, the International Police Space Force flagship, and until very recently his father's own command, parked and keeping station a few miles from Babylon 6. Not far away was the sleek and imposing bulk of a Seleucian Arcadia-class battleship in the colors of the Imperial Guards.
I'm forbidden to go see what they're up to until tomorrow, Corwin added.
Ah. Well, good luck.
Thanks. I'm in the lane now. Request docking clearance.
Roger, one-hit wonder. Docking clearance granted. Stand by for ADC handover.
A moment later, a light appeared on his helm console, indicating that the station's automatic docking control system was requesting handover. Corwin flipped the appropriate toggle switch from off to auto. In a small window below the switch, a mechanical indicator switched from displaying a blank gray flag to one with alternating gray and white slanted stripes.
Thank you, Babylon Control, he said. ADC is Barberpold. You have control. One-hit wonder out.
Guided by the tractor beams and remote helm inputs of the ADC, the Wonder flew serenely into the yawning opening on the front of Babylon 6, then was shunted off from the central core through an atmosphere retention field and to a gentle landing in one of the smaller hangar bays. One she shared, Corwin noticed, with his father's slightly newer Corellian, Dagger Disc. Disembarking from the ship, he locked up, shouldered his duffel bag, and walked across the hangar, past Dagger Disc, to the exit. When he emerged into the interior hallway, he turned right without thinking about it. Intending to head for the quarters in Green Sector, outboard, nowhere near the garden, where the Valiant's crew always stayed when they stopped aboard B-6. Just before he reached the lift, though, he noticed a figure blocking his path and stopped.
Wrong way, champ, said his mother with a smile. You're in the VOQ tonight.
Corwin sighed, his shoulders sagging. This is ridiculous, he grumbled as he let Skuld turn him around and start guiding him back the other way.
This is what you asked for, a traditional Asgardian ceremony with all the trimmings, and this is what you get. You're lucky your grandmother's even letting you have it in Midgard.
She would certainly not stand for you seeing your bride the day before the wedding.
Corwin rolled his eyes and replied, Just for the record, I asked for no such thing.
Yeah, well, when your grandparents are the Allfather and his wife, sometimes you just have to humor them, Skuld pointed out. Anyway, how'd it go? Did you get it?
Corwin shook the duffel bag on his shoulder a little bit, eliciting a muffled metallic rattle.
Yes, and remind me never, ever to do anything like this again.
I can't believe I raised a son with such a stunted sense of adventure, Skuld jokingly complained.
Knowing he wouldn't win anyway, he let her guide him to the visiting officer's quarters, past the security officer, why a security officer here, and to the stateroom all the way at the end.
Stay on this deck, Skuld told him. Don't roam around. We don't want to take any chances.
Corwin sighed. Yes, ma'am, he said heavily.
Skuld smirked slightly, kissed him on the cheek, and said, Just one more day. Your attendance will be here at 10:30.
Corwin acknowledged the implicit instruction to be ready, endured a few moments of sentimentality from his misty-eyed mother, and saw her off, then shut the door and wondered what the hell to do with himself for the next, glance at watch, 20 hours. Well, there was always sleeping. Gods knew he hadn't done a lot of that in the last 48.
With that in mind, Corbin flopped onto his bunk, sighed, and lay there for a few minutes with his forearm across his forehead, regarding the ceiling expressionlessly. Then, as a thought struck him, he moved his arm away from his head and regarded his wristwatch for a moment.
Hell, I'm not going to see her, he thought, and reached out with his consciousness.
The contact took only a moment to establish, and when it was made he felt a combination of surprise and faint, conspiratorial amusement filter back to him.
Hey, he said.
Hey yourself, Uchina replied. Isn't this bad luck?
Pah, errant superstition.
How you holding up?
Fine, fine, she said, and Corwin snickered a little bit, because she sounded just like his father when she said that.
You?
Tired, but intact. I'm confined to the VOQ up in blue for the evening. How's your outfit coming along?
Belle's outdone herself. I think you'll like it.
Of course I will. Mind you, I'd be just as happy if you showed up in blue jeans and one of my old Pendleton shirts.
Getting kicks the guests will never understand, Uchna observed, her smirk carrying across the lens link.
Would they dare to suck a sleeve? Corwin asked rhetorically.
Anyway, I just wanted to check in, let you know I made it back.
And buck the system a little, he agreed. Guess I'll see you tomorrow, then, he added, unconvincingly nonchalant.
Yeah, if I don't think of something better to do in the meantime, Uchina replied. Have a good night, Corbin.
You too, he said, and then the link was gone. He looked at his watch again and gave himself a wry smile. Good night. It wasn't even 3 p.m. yet. If he went to sleep now, he'd be waking up sometime in the evening, his schedule completely disrupted, unable to go back to sleep at all, and with a grueling day of rather complicated, almost entirely unrehearsed theatricality to get through. No, that wouldn't do at all. He'd have to stay awake until at least 2100. 2200 would be better. And with that, he fell asleep.
Colonial Battlestar Aurora, SDF-100. Undisclosed location. Kosoe Kaworu, Prospective Warrior number 326-3827, Viper Squadron VX-1 Cadet Group A, stood in the corridor just off the Battlestar's port hangar bay, not far from the door leading to the Rogue Squadron Ready Room, and thence to the Squadron Commander's office. She'd just landed following a practical flight exercise in one of the squadron's VT-8 Logan Veritech trainers, and was still dressed in the orange pressure suit that marked her as a trainee, helmet in one hand. Out there in the black, she'd been cool, collected, on top of things. In here, on the other hand, she was fighting a small battle with herself. What she wanted to do was go in there and ask Wedge Antilles to find an excuse to send her to Babylon 6 tomorrow. There was no provision in colonial regulations for granting leave to PWs during selection, but Wedge had been known to bend the regs concerning student field exercises to accommodate real-world needs, and her scores in the ongoing evaluation were near the top of her group. If she pitched it right, he might just oblige her. But how would you pitch something like this to a person who was even relatively near normal? Listen, Wedge, it's just that my ex-boyfriend is getting married tomorrow to the girl I dumped him so he could be with, and I'd like to be there, you know, show my support in that. Sure, that'd be fixed up. She might get the weekend off, but it'd be for a psych evaluation, not Corwin's wedding. She wrestled with it for a few minutes, but finally decided that there was no way she could explain the situation that wouldn't seem completely stupid to an outsider. She'd just reached that conclusion when one of her roommates, Kara Starbuck Thrace, came around the corner from the landing bay and saw her. "Hey, Kaworu, what are you doing?" she asked. Then, as she remembered the outcome of other cadets' bouts of introspection outside Wedge's office, she added with some concern, "You're not thinking of quitting, are you?"
Kozue turned and gave her a look.
Of course not, she scoffed. Just thinking about something.
Yeah, well, think about it and walk at the same time, whatever it is, Starbuck advised, sweeping Kozue into step as she passed. Stand around in the hall all afternoon and you'll miss chow call.
Chief's Office, IPO Office Complex, Blue Sector, Babylon 6.
Somehow Griffin knew before the Turing evaluator spoke that she wasn't going to say anything he wanted to hear. The young Vulcan didn't, or rather did, disappoint him. Putting her duraluminum briefcase on the floor, she sat down in the chair facing his desk, fastidiously smoothed the skirt of her dark-colored, severely cut professional suit, and said as diplomatically as a young Vulcan could,
I have bad news for you, Chief. Your request is denied.
Maybe you'd like to expand on that, Dr. Takir? Griffin prompted after a few seconds' cool silence.
You will receive a copy of my report when it is filed with the board, Takir told him. Then, seeing him scowl, preparatory to objecting, she relented slightly and went on. But in simple terms, there are very specific criteria governing what subjects are eligible for field certification, and neither of the two subjects you are sponsoring on this occasion meet them.
Griffin considered his next statement, then said carefully, I'd be obliged if you would elaborate a bit further. He could have sworn Takir was suppressing a sigh as she weighed his request, then said,
Subject 1 is the only operational example of a brand new robot type about which we have received very little in the way of technical information. It has been functional for only 7 weeks. I do not have a sufficient foundation of baseline information on which to base a finding for or against certification.
Eve, said Griffin.
I beg your pardon?
Her name is Eve. She's not an it.
I am not here to defend my choice of pronoun, Takir said, just a touch frostily. As for Subject 2, there we face the opposite problem. There is a great wealth of data available on the U.S. Robotics Wall series, the Class E units especially. More than 20 million of them were manufactured. Many individuals remained in service for more than a century, and there are no documented cases of a Wall E unit ever achieving certifiable sapience. Again, instant field certification is not indicated in this case.
Griffin considered pointing out the intangible factors he'd recognized in both robots since their arrival following Eve's field mission, but decided he'd be wasting his time. Many Vulcans, even those trained at the Science Academy, were capable of spotting and appreciating such nuances. It was fairly apparent that Takir wasn't one of them. It wasn't because she was Vulcan, of course. It was simply that she lacked imagination, or situational zanshin. However you wanted to phrase it, she just didn't get it, and there wasn't anything Griffin was going to be able to do about it.
What happens next? He asked instead.
I will submit my report to the board. They will consider the matter and decide whether to proceed with a conventional evaluation. If they choose to pursue the matter, you will be notified when to present yourself and your sponsored subjects at the Institute. Since your initial request was for a field certification, the process will automatically be expedited. You should receive notification within 3 standard weeks. She rose, collected her briefcase, and nodded cordially but without any semblance of warmth. My part in the process is concluded at this point. If you have further questions, please direct them to the Institute Advocate here on the station. Good day, Chief.
Annoyed though he might have been, no one could fault Griffin's manners. He rose to his feet, presented her with the Vulcan salute, and said with apparent, if resigned, sincerity,
Live long and prosper, Dr. Takir. Takir's near-blank affect cracked just a little bit as she gave a single blink of surprise.
Over the course of 5 years with the Institute, including 3 as a field evaluator in the new Instant Certification Program, she'd grown accustomed to humans telling her to take it easy, or have a good one. Or, if she'd just failed to meet their preconceived expectations in some particularly irritating way, get the hell out of here. To receive a proper Vulcan farewell from one was just a little bit startling. Still, she recovered almost instantly, inclined her head with less perfunctory cordiality than before, returned the salute, and replied, "Peace and long life, Mr. Hutchins." Then she turned and left. A moment later, as Griffin was lowering himself back into his chair and sighing, amber-eyed Luornu Durgo looked around the doorway from the outer office and remarked, "I bet she's the life of any party." Griffin chuckled. "Well, she's got a job to do," he said, trying to show equanimity. "And she's determined to do it by the book." He sighed. So tempted to conquer the universe right now. Then he picked up the phone on his desk and grumbled, "Guess I'd better give the kids the bad news. Looks like we're gonna have to do the whole damn dog and pony show." Visiting Diplomatic Quarters, Green Sector. Once more, Ujna Tenjo read over the list of things she'd be expected to do, know, and say the following day. Once more, she was quite certain she'd committed it all to memory, until she put it down, at which point she became equally convinced that she'd forgotten at least one important step. Not since she'd helped conclude a diplomatic protocol securing the independence of Tau Ceti from the Earth Alliance on Galactic TV had she been so keenly aware of the importance of getting the dance right. She sighed, tossed the list onto the coffee table, and then flopped sideways on the couch, rolling onto her back. "We should have just gone to Vegas," she grumbled. "You don't mean that," the other person in the room chided her. Ujna raised herself up on her elbows and looked across to the armchair, where her Asgardian advisor cum chaperone, the person assigned by the implacable forces coordinating her impending wedding to ensure that she knew what to do, what not to do, and when to do and not do them, sat smiling impishly at her. "No, I suppose I don't," Ujna admitted. Then she let herself fall onto her back again and added wryly, "I'm sure when it's all done with, I'll only remember the sense of occasion, and not the fact that the prep work was like doing my taxes." Said Vigdis Brightblade. "Such a cynic. What happened to that idealistic little girl I used to know?" "Big talk from an overgrown 12-year-old," said Ujna. "Hey now, that was a long time ago. If I hadn't adjusted my age, I'd be 18 now. When you were 18, you'd already conquered the universe." Then, shifting gears, the red-headed Valkyrie rapped out a quick question. "What's the first thing you do when you reach the top of the platform?" Ujna blinked. She'd known the answer to that until 1/100th of a second after Vigdis asked it, but now her mind was a complete blank. "Quickly, quickly," Vigdis said, snapping her fingers insistently. "Everyone is staring at you."
"I make obeisance to the All-Mother," Ujna said, convinced she was wrong.
"Correct. Very good," Vigdis said. "And then?"
"And then? Then I..."
Ujna trailed off, then sat up again and gave Vigdis a comically exaggerated dark grin. "Then, in all likelihood, I snap and challenge someone to a duel." Vigdis sighed.
"I wish you'd take this seriously," she said, her tone holding more resignation than reproach. "I know it's not a way you're accustomed to acting, but our traditions are important to us in Asgard. And by playing along, at least for a few minutes, you show that you respect the culture you're marrying into." Utina's grin faded away. She pulled herself the rest of the way upright, folded her legs under her, and sighed, propping her elbows on her knees.
"I know, V," she said. "I really do. And I'm trying, honestly I am. I just... it's... hard. I know, this was my idea, and it's damned late in the game to be having second thoughts, but I can't help it. I have to find a way to do all this without feeling like I'm compromising my principles. I worked so hard to make sure I would never be anyone's princess."
"I know," said Vigdis, nodding. "And now you're accustomed to thinking like... well, like a man, more or less. You're the husband in your marriage to Lady Anthe, and thanks to the way the Grand Tournament was framed, you have a lot of emotional baggage attached to the term and the concept of being someone's bride. But you can put your mind at ease on at least one account."
"Oh?"
Vigdis smiled. "You've never been, you will never be, a princess to Corwin. He wouldn't know what to do with a princess. Oh, he'd rescue one, sure. He's a knight in shining armor, after all. But then he'd just take her home to her castle and ride off into the mist. You're something entirely different to him." She got up from her chair and moved to the end of the couch, drawing herself up into a position similar to Utina's facing her. "You met Corwin when he was little more than a Midgardian boy, and though you've watched him grow into a man and a god, I think that first impression still colors some of your expectations unconsciously," she said. "But you must always bear in mind that he is, first and foremost, one of the Æsir. He is, in his heart of hearts, a Norseman, and Norsemen are not like other men. They have no need, no use, and no wish for their wives to be helpless chattel. A Norseman needs a wife who stands beside him, not behind." She smiled again and went on. "In the old days, when marriages in Asgard were usually arranged, the first question a young man asked when told that his elders had found him a bride was not, 'Is she beautiful?' It was, 'Is she good with a sword?'" The smile became a faint smirk as she added, "It's just a sign of how much Corwin is favored by fate that you're both." Utina laughed, then sobered and said, "I think I see what you're saying. Honestly, I'm not worried that Corwin's going to change, to suddenly come over all domineering. That's just silly. It's just that a lot of the symbolism in the ritual..." She shook her head. "It's my damage, not yours. I'll survive." Vigdis reached and took both of her hands, looking her intently in the eyes. "I don't want you to simply survive," she insisted. "I want the day to be joyous for you. Else what's the point? You could simply file some papers at City Hall in New Avalon and be done with it. I'm trying to make you understand. You look at our customs, our ceremony, through the prism of your own experiences and see symbols of subjugation, but they're not. They're tokens of the highest respect. In some cases of..." She searched briefly for the word. "Of exaltation." The young Valkyrie hesitated, then plowed on. "I'm probably not supposed to tell you this in so many words, but think about it. We are, in effect, making you a goddess tomorrow, Utina." Utina blinked, struck speechless. "You are marrying Corwin," Vigdis replied to the astounded look in her eyes. "You are joining his family. His mother is a Norn. Her father is the Allfather. Any woman Corwin would choose to take as his wife must be worthy to stand among the gods themselves. This isn't just symbolic to us. Odin and Frigg would not have permitted this, much less taken a personal hand in making it happen, if they did not believe you were such a person. At best, they would simply ignore the matter and hope the fancy passed,
as they did at first when Vertandi married Keiichi Morisato without permission. At worst, one or the other of them, probably Frigg, would step in and take action to see you parted. Instead, they're taking part. I know you probably see it as in-law meddling and frippery, but they're taking it very, very seriously. They honor Corwin's choice with their involvement. The Allfather intends to see you welcomed to his family by the hand of his own wife, the goddess of all wives. I can't possibly exaggerate the significance of that.
Warming to the subject now, she went on with passion in her voice. This is a tremendous honor. All Asgard is prepared to hail you tomorrow. Utna Gripensdottir, Tenjo the Bold, who won the right to call the Midgard Knight father, and the very heart of Valhalla's cavalier in silver and black, with her courage, skill, and virtue.
With chin high and flashing emerald eyes almost defiant, Vigdis declared, So wear your wedding crown with pride tomorrow, my sister, because it isn't meant to represent a shackle, like the trappings of your old foe's cruel game.
Lowering her voice and gazing straight into Utna's eyes, speaking with the careful intensity of one who wants to make sure she is absolutely understood, Vigdis finished,
It's a victor's laurel. You are a conquering hero, and tomorrow's ceremony is your triumph.
Utna just stared at her for a few seconds before at last finding her voice.
Vigdis, I never thought of it like that. Thank you.
Then, letting out a wide-eyed, cheek-puffing breath, she blinked and added,
Boy, no pressure there.
Vigdis laughed, as if consciously shrugging off the gravity of her little speech.
Sorry, she said. I didn't mean to lay it on quite that thick. I mean, it's all true, but it's best not to dwell on it at length. Keep it in mind, but don't let it dominate your thoughts. Not the easiest balancing act in the world, I admit.
She sighed, coming down from the high of emotion that had swept her along as she made her speech.
I'm sorry, she repeated. I shouldn't have laid it all out so bluntly as that. Now you'll be hard-pressed not to feel even more self-conscious. And to think I started talking because I wanted to put you at ease.
Utna smiled and took her hands again.
It's okay, she said. Actually, I feel better knowing what the stakes really are, probably because of all the time I spent blundering around in the dark during the tournament. I have a lot of respect for the cultures Corwin comes from, both of them. But you're right. I understand his Earthman half more or less instinctively. Understanding his Aesir half... That takes a conscious effort, and until just now I was so caught up in the physical details, what to say, what to do, when to do it, that I never took the time to see the context. I was so bogged down in what and when that I never thought about why.
Then, with a wry grin, she added,
See, this is why sequestering me from Anthy for the preparations was a bad plan. She's the one who usually thinks of these things for me.
Vigdis grinned.
So noted, she said.
Now, Utna said, leaning to retrieve the list from the coffee table. Let's go over it again. I want to make sure I get this right.
IPOVOQ, Blue Sector. Corwin woke to find the lights of his stateroom automatically dimmed. He knew from experience that, on Babylon 6, this meant it was sometime between 2100 and 0500 hours, and that meant, like as not, that he had blown it. He turned over, looked at the time display in the instrument cluster on the bulkhead next to the bunk, and sighed. Yep. 2115. 9:15 p.m. Avalon Standard Time.
Shit, he grumbled, sitting up.
It was, he knew, no good trying to go back to sleep now. If he was lucky, he'd be able to grab a nap on the other end, an hour or two before his attendants came to roust him. But in the meantime, the long night shift stretched empty before him. He wasn't worried about being tired for the ceremony tomorrow. He had reserves to draw on, ways of ensuring that he'd be wide awake. He didn't need, though he would gladly take, weather permitting, as much sleep as a normal man anyway. There was just the question of what to do for the next 11 hours, especially since he wasn't technically supposed to leave the VOQ. Well, he thought, I've got the run of this res block, I can at least go for a walk. Indeed, if he played his cards right, maybe he'd even be able to slip down to the Wonder and get his book, which, like an idiot, he could see it in his mind's eye, he'd left sitting on the table in the wardroom. There was still a uniformed security officer on duty by the lift, though it was a different guy. Corwin wondered idly whether he'd try to stop him from leaving the floor, but in fact he just looked up from whatever he was doing on his portable terminal, nodded, and went back to it. Corwin was able to get over to the hangar deck and aboard the Wonder, unchallenged. He supposed wryly that his mother and the others probably didn't feel it would be necessary to post anyone to keep him from leaving. He found his book right where he expected it to be, collected it, and made ready to leave. As he locked up the Wonder again, he pondered that perverse impulse that always nags a man to do whatever he's least supposed to be doing. On an ordinary Thursday evening, without an explicit ban on stopping by Green Sector, he might well spend the night alone in the VOQ, or aboard the Wonder, or wherever, and not think twice about it. But because he was specifically not supposed to go to Green and see anyone there tonight, he found himself unable to muster much enthusiasm for doing anything else. Sighing, Corwin headed back upstairs, resigning himself to an evening of distractedly reading the same page over and over again without comprehending what was on it. He waved glumly to the security guy when he arrived back on the VOQ block, and had almost reached his quarters, when the door of the second room from the end opened and a sleek, white, pod-like figure nearly collided with him. "Whoa," he said, half dancing back as the white shape skidded to an aerial halt and backed up a little. He knew what she, his instincts at once corrected him, was immediately. Having followed the development of the EVE series from afar with a professional's interest, but he had never actually seen one before. As far as he knew, only one existed, though the last he'd been aware the prototype was still on test assignment. He didn't know more than the basic spec sheet stuff about the series, since he hadn't been involved in the actual development process, but, watching the floating robot's body language as she backed up, looked him over, and then glanced up the hall at the security man, he got the distinct impression she was anxious about something. She was about to turn and make for the lift when Corwin asked, "What's the matter? Maybe I can help." Eve looked at him again, hesitating. Then a blue-white light shone from beneath her smooth white casing, on her right side, just below the rim of her repulsor field neck, and scanned him up and down. As it did so, a row of three white lights below the scan source, on what Corwin supposed you'd call her chest, lit up one by one, followed by a larger green one that was accompanied by a musical tone. Eve's light matrix eyes blinked, then widened, as her internal sub-ether linked the IPO's master database returned a positive identification based on her scan. Ravenhair, Corwin V., born June 25th, 2391, Nekomikoka, Tomodachi. Son of Ravenhair, Skuld, IPO Prime Technologist, and Hutchins, Benjamin, Griffin, IPO Chief. Roboticist, Weapons Engineer, Spacecraft Designer. Creator of Record, Armored Knight G. Kaiser, Getter Robo Series, Gaugaigar System. Sponsored Personal Robot, R. Dorothy Wainwright, XREF. For Turing Certification, 2405. Suitability, high. Confidence, high. Eve immediately aborted her original plan, which was to get to the lift shaft and try to summon help from the station's robot repair facilities down in Red Sector. Instead, she grabbed Corwin's sleeve. Like his father, he was struck by how cunningly articulated her hands were, and tugged him into the room from which she'd just emerged. Gesturing to another, much less sleek, robotic figure in the middle of the room, Eve turned pleading eyes to Corwin and said, "Help." Corwin blinked, put his book down on the table by the door, then went and crouched by the other robot. This was a much earlier model, a small and blocky utility droid, and it had obviously seen a lot of wear and tear. It took Corwin a moment to realize that he was at least passingly familiar with the model, a U.S. Robotics Wall-E unit. He'd seen one in the Tomodachi Colonization Museum. "Hello," said Corwin. The industrial robot turned its binocular-like head toward him, its optics focusing, and then slowly, shakily raised one fork-like manipulator.
"Wall-E,"
it croaked. Corwin looked momentarily taken aback, then realized that the robot wanted to shake hands. In even that small gesture, his practiced eye could see that this, too, was no mere it. He smiled, shook the offered hand, and said, "Hi, I'm Corwin. Looks like you're having some motor problems." Wall-E nodded. His head was about the only part of him he could move without difficulty, it seemed. He seemed alert, and he didn't look particularly alarmed, just a bit puzzled. "Can you fill me in, Eve?" Corwin asked his impromptu patience hovering companion. "Wally's having a hard time getting his signaler working." Then, switching to a weird, high-pitched, trilling language, he added, "Go ahead and code stream it if you want." Eve was markedly taken aback by this development. She'd never encountered a human who could understand the audio-streamed burst code robots commonly use to converse among themselves when they weren't using packet radio, much less speak it. His accent was horrible. It wasn't a form of communication that human speaking apparatus was very well suited to, but intelligible. "We were dancing and he just stopped," she coded when she'd recovered from her surprise. "His energy levels are okay, but I don't know his diagnostic language well enough to pin down the source of the trouble. I think there must be something wrong in his subprocessor array." "Hmm. Maybe," Corbin mused, speaking normally again. If he thought it at all weird that two robots had been dancing in an otherwise empty stateroom on the VOQ, he gave no sign. "I'm not too familiar with his model, but the old saints always did this kind of thing when their motivator diodes blew. Have you got a Phillips screwdriver?" Better than that, she had a sonic screwdriver. They had Wally's front panel off in seconds. "Hmm," said Corwin, peering inside with the aid of a spotlight Eve was projecting, like her scan grid, from within her casing. "Well, you've got a lot of corroded leads in here, little fella. That can't be helping." He gingerly moved a couple of circuit boards, leaving them connected by their faded old ribbon cables, and then nodded. "Yep. Looks like your central motivator diode has failed, and the backups, well, they look like they were already gone." He turned to Eve. "I don't suppose you've got any spares around?" "No," she replied, looking alarmed. "We have plenty of spare parts for his mechanical systems, but almost no electronics. They didn't weather the scrapyard very well." Corwin sat back on his haunches and rubbed the back of his head thoughtfully. "If we were in my workshop back in New Avalon, I could fix this no problem. I've got a whole box full of stuff that'd work. And all my tools, for that matter." Then, remembering something he'd seen on the EVE Mark 35 spec sheet, he turned to Eve with a smile spreading slowly onto his face. "How'd you like to run a little search-and-retrieve mission for me?" he asked. Eve became instantly attentive. "Directive," she said out loud. In the small stateroom set aside for him next to his office up on the admin level, Griffin looked up from the book he was working on at the chime of the intercom panel.
"Chief, Stargate Control," said a voice.
"Go ahead, Stargate Control," he replied.
"Chief, Lieutenant Perkins here. We just had an uncommanded Stargate activation, and that new Stark Industries probe droid came through here like a bat out of hell. Looks like the destination was HQ New Avalon. What's your recommendation?"
Griffin raised an eyebrow.
I recommend that you don't stand in front of the gate, Lieutenant," he replied. "If she went through alone, she'll be back."
"Roger that, Chief. Stargate Control out." While Eve was gone, Corwin busied himself with a deeper investigation into which systems needed overhauls, which was pretty much all of them, and what parts they had on hand. While he was in no particular danger from the particular hardware failure that had befallen him, so while he took stock, Corwin made light conversation.
"Seems like you've really been through the grind, my friend," he observed as he jotted a diagram of Wally's main subprocessor array on a piece of VOQ stationery.
"How'd you end up here on B6?
Wally tilted his head, considering how to reply, and then croaked,
"Eva."
Corwin smiled.
"Ah," he said. "Cherchez la femme, eh? I don't blame you. She's beautiful." Wally mustered the effort to wiggle slightly, clearly pleased that Corwin thought so. He wasn't completely naive. He knew most humans would simply have been humoring him with a remark like that, but some bit of cybernetic intuition told him that this human was different. This one meant it. He could see, he understood. That knowledge made Wally much more comfortable with the prospect of being in his hands, with the help of Eve's, of course, for the delicate repairs to come.